This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Fans of the Netflix comedy Master of None might remember the episode Thanksgiving. It follows the character Denise through three Thanksgivings in her life. It also traces the story of her coming out and the gradual acceptance she receives from her mother.
I think this is going to be a lovely Thanksgiving, Denise.
Yeah, I think so.
And I like Michelle.
I like her too.
I'm happy for you.
That actress Lena Waithe won an Emmy Award for that episode. She also made history by becoming the first black woman to win the Emmy for outstanding comedy writing.
My LGBTQIA family, I see each and every one of you. The things that make us different, those are our superpowers.
Since that win, Lena Waithe has been very busy. She's the creator of The Chi on Showtime and a producer of Dear White People on Netflix. She's also got a lot of projects in the pipeline. Boomerang on BET, 20s on TBS, and the unscripted series You Ain't Got These about the culture of people who geek out over sneakers. Lena and I spoke on stage in San Francisco as part of a yearly conference called ComNet. It's led by a group called the Communications Network, a peer-driven group of nonprofit communications professionals. Here's my conversation with Lena Waithe.
What do you do for a living?
I make art, but I think I'm a person that documents the lives of people of color, so that way when we're gone that no one will forget we were here.
How straight a path do you feel it was to get to the point where you are, where that's your definition of what you do for a living? Did you always have a beat on that, or did it kind of evolve over time?
I think that I am a product of that storytelling. I watched stories about people that look like me as a young person in Chicago trying to find myself or figure out what I meant to the world. And I think I only saw that by looking into a television that was sort of a reflection. And I came up at a time where A Different World was on, Cosby Show, Family Matters, Fresh Prince. But then I also watched old television shows like The Mary Tyler Moore Show or Maude, On the Family, Good Times. And so I always sort of knew everything I knew about human behavior through fictitious characters. And I think that really had a huge impact on me. So it was always this thing of wanting to become a master of who we are as human beings and then try to find some sort of truth in that that everyone can relate to. So that is sort of like the path I began, watching stories and then wanting to tell my own.
Did you, when you were watching TV, because I think you and I grew up with a lot of the same shows, mm-hmm. Did you look at those shows and say, I identify with that, that's my life? Or did you look at those shows and feel kind of the distance between that fantasy and your reality?
I think I looked at them, because like, here's the thing, The Cosby Show didn't reflect where I lived or how I lived, but it reflected who we are. Like my family, there was a lot of love, there was a lot of respect, there was a lot of appreciation for the elders. So even though the specifics weren't the same, but the feeling was, and I understood how powerful that was to be sitting in a space, being raised by a single parent, living with my grandmother, and I never felt disconnected to the world in which I lived, but I felt very important when I watched that show, because I knew so many other people were watching it and they looked like me, and it made me feel less invisible.
You've talked about living on Chicago South Side until you were 12, mm-hmm. and then your mother moving you to Evanston, which mm-hmm. is a suburb of yeah. Chicago, which you have described in one profile as being like an effing Benetton ad. You didn't mm-hmm. say effing, but
yeah.
You know, this is a family conference, so I'll say effing. What was that transition like for you as a preteen, going from the South? I think about, it almost makes me think about that show, The Boondocks, where you mm-hmm. have these two characters who are kind of plucked out of one environment, dropped in another one, and expected to kind of become part of that space when they're just not kind of wired for it. But what was it like for you?
I mean, it wasn't really a huge shock for me. I think because I just very, very early on knew how to step into a space and either own it or step into the space and be a part of it. And I was very blessed in that way. I think I was always a bit of a ham. Maybe it came from watching so much movies and TV. I always really knew how to be the life of the party and how to entertain. And so I never really had an issue stepping into a space, but it was unique to me because like I didn't know what a stay-at-home mom was until I was around white people. and because I remember going to a student's house and her mom was there and I was like, what's your mom doing here? Like, where did she go home? That kind of stuff exposed me to different things and like people and how other people live. And I think that is always important because that then gives me this broader scope. So that way, you know, it's the difference between Spike Lee and Tyler Perry. You know what I'm saying? It's like there's, if you only see one thing and know one thing, then that is going to be what you spit out. But because I was exposed to so many different things, just naturally, and the other things I wanted to search or find or become obsessed with, like it kind of helped. It helped the way I look at the world.
Did you ever feel like you had to code switch?
Well, all black people are bilingual. I mean, but I think that I actually don't, or I think that was a thing that I really didn't adopt, because I realized that who I was more fascinating than me making a room full of white people comfortable. So me speaking the way I speak or walking the way I walk or being who I am actually got me more attention than me trying to blend or assimilate.
We got a number of questions from some of the folks who are here for the conference who submitted questions in advance. We'll get to as many of them as we can. One person wrote, growing up in Chicago has clearly influenced your work, obviously evidenced by your hit show, The Chi. Mm. Chicago may be the most stereotyped city in America right now. How have you used representation to paint a different picture?
Well, to me, I when I sat down to write it, it really was just this desire to tell a very raw and uncut and just human story about the people that live there and go to work every day and are raising kids and trying to get into heaven. So I really didn't sit down with any other intention than that. I felt like people were talking about the city or writing about it in a way, it was really from a foreigner's perspective. And being someone that obviously is from there, and that's the first home I ever knew, I just know the people, and I know how salt of the earth they are. I know how hardworking they are. I know how conflicted they can be sometimes because the city can be tough. And so for me, I just wanted to tell their story. And I always say I don't care about the police. If there's ever a police story in there, it's because it's sort of forced in. But I care about those who are being policed. I don't care about the system. I care about the people the system affects. I think that's always where I've come from, and I think that's really the place I wanted to start with the show, and I think that's a big reason why a lot of the character names are people directly from my life. Like, I mean, I have an Uncle Ronnie. My mother's name is Laverne. Her first name is Ethel. I knew a kid, you know, named Brandon. I also grew up with a kid named Coogie, whose name we still don't know. and so I just... I really put so much of, and then also my Uncle Ronnie dated a chick named Tracy. Like, I really put myself in it. And I was like, if they can see sort of these sprinkles of our blackness and our humanness, that they will see that we are not the monsters in which people make us out to be.
Could I ask you to circle back to something you said earlier? At least two people who are listening right now have kind of tweeted and quoted you on talking about wanting to document the lives of people of color so that people will remember us after we're all long gone.
Mm-hmm.
How do you view that? Like, what is it that is, what do you see in terms of us all being long gone? Is that what you think that we as a people are kind of inexorably heading towards? Can you elaborate on that?
Well, here's the deal. James Baldwin wrote about us. Lorraine Hansberry wrote about us. And he is gone. She is gone, Martin is gone, Malcolm is gone. Like Lorraine Hansberry wrote the quintessential story of us. And you know, she lived, I mean, she died. I mean, she was around, I think, my age when she left us. she will never be forgotten, even though her body is now one with the earth. Her story is one that will live on forever and ever and ever because people will keep telling it, people will keep talking about it. But she didn't write that, I think, for her own glory. I don't think she sat in front of a typewriter, chain-smoking cigarettes, thinking, I want to be remembered. She wanted us to be remembered. She wanted to make sure that people understood what it meant to be Black and what it meant to want to be an elephant and not an ant. She knew, but yet the world keeps telling you you're an ant, but you know you're an elephant. And I think Sidney Poitier's performance will always be haunting because it always is the story of a Black male to want to be a king, but to be treated like a peasant. And but not only to want to be a king, but to be a king and to be treated like a peasant.
You're listening to part of our interview with actress, producer, writer, and showrunner Lena Waithe, recorded this year in San Francisco at the conference ComNet 18, which is held for PR and communications professionals. We'll get back to that conversation in just a moment.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from the YMCA, a nonprofit committed to strengthening communities. The Y believes the zip code you're born into shouldn't determine your destiny and works to create opportunity for all, no matter who you are or where you're from. Learn more about the impact of your donation at ymca.net/forabetterus. The Y, for a better us.
I'm Stacey Vanek Smith, co-host of The Indicator from Planet Money, where every day we tell you a short story about the economy. Get The Indicator on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
With regard to your work in television, Laura Nash from the Northwest Health Foundation asks, from your perspective, what is television's role in reinforcing and or challenging common narratives? And she gives some examples of hardworking individuals pulling themselves up by the bootstraps versus the so-called welfare queen taking advantage of America's taxpayers. How does television reinforce some of America's favorite narratives or perhaps myths and stereotypes?
Here's the thing, this is what I will say. We've never had a Black person run a major studio, right? In the town, in Hollywood, it's never happened. We've had a Black person run the country. We never had a Black person run a major motion picture studio. it's true, never had a Black bachelor. So I believe that a microphone is more powerful than a grenade. It just is. You have so much power with that. So I think there's a couple things. I mean, there is money to be made in telling and enforcing common narratives. But we can't necessarily blame other people for that because the truth is that sometimes, say, Black people enjoy a common Black narrative. You know, there's the whole empire built around that, where it's sort of like almost, minstrelsy has sort of changed its face, but it still exists. And it's not just, you know, everybody enjoys that. You know, there's a part of people that like that. So you can't, the color that matters most in Hollywood is green. So if the common narratives continue to make money or bring viewership, then it'll always exist. Now, there's more uncommon narratives that are happening, like Atlanta or Random Acts of Flyness, Dear White People, Get Out, Moonlight. The more people show up for those things and those narratives, then the more, and I think people have. I think it's starting to happen. The shift is starting to turn. But I also think both will exist. You can have, you know, foie gras on a Wednesday, and you can also have McDonald's on a Friday. It's just a matter of, you know, but I don't think it's anyone's job. I don't know if I believe in that. I think we as artists, you know, put our work into the world, and we have no power over how it's received.
Let me dig a little bit deeper into what you just said in terms of there having been a black president but never a black studio executive.
Studio head.
There have been black studio executives for sure. Dig deeper into that on a practical level. So suppose that I, you know, Joshua Johnson became the head of, you know, whatever studio, Sony or Paramount or Fox or whatever. Give me some practical examples from your work of what difference that would make when someone like you comes in and says, hey, I got this project, this is what I want to do and this is how I want it done. What are some of the levers that I as a studio head get to pull as a black studio head that make a difference for a creator, for a storyteller of color? Give me a few examples.
Well, the truth is like, I mean, I think it might be too hypothetical, but because at the end of the day, I can walk into a white studio head's office and convince him to sell something because I represent a brand. I'm a commodity. So that's not, I think, where it needs to go. It's more about someone who doesn't have a brand, someone who is very talented and has a lot of potential, but wasn't on the cover of Vanity Fair. Like, it's about getting that person into the room, because buying something from me don't get you no brownie points. Because that's like going, that worked, okay, let's do it again. Like, okay. It's more about someone who walks through the world with a different perspective, and someone who's willing to take risks, and someone who is willing to roll up their sleeves and look for a piece of talent that hasn't really been discovered yet, that needs to be nurtured. And look, at the end of the day, you know, every brother ain't a brother. So having Clarence Thomas on the Supreme Court doesn't serve any of us. So it's more about who is the studio head? What are their intentions? What do they want to do? Because I do think sometimes they can place us in positions to keep us complacent. So it really is more about making sure whoever that person is, when the day comes, it'll be a glorious day. But I hope to make sure that that person is Thurgood and not Clarence.
How much more do you think that Hollywood is mindful in a practical sense of the need to portray diversity on screen? I mean, this year we've had a few big hit movies with all or mostly you know, diverse casts. And some of them have been big budget films like Black Panther and Crazy Rich Asians and so on.
Yeah.
And those are big hits.
I was at both premieres. It was great.
And I think we did.
Was amazing at both parties.
I bet. I think we did both of those movies on 1A for the movie club as well. But the question always comes up whether or not this is actually a sign of the times or whether this is kind of too noteworthy. And then you have Moonlight literally taking the Best Picture Oscar away from La La Land, like literally.
As it should. I don't know.
Right.
No, I love Damien.
Right. I think one of the questions that keeps coming up for people who comment on our program is whether this means we have, for lack of a better word, arrived. Like, where we are in the struggle, if you have Black Panther that does so well and Crazy Rich Asians that does so well and Moonlight that wins the Academy Award for Best Picture of the Year, like, roll the credits and we all lived happily ever after, right?
Look, here's the thing. I think when Empire happened, it was a fad. When Atlanta happens, we're in vogue. I think when Get Out happens, we are the culture. So, but here's the truth. We've always been the culture. It's just that our bodies are just being used for a profit. And that's something that we are very familiar with. But I think that the difference now, in my opinion, is that the industry has recognized that layered, complex stories about people who happen to be people of color are profitable and prestigious. Those are everybody's favorite two P's. Because you want box office, but you also want awards. So that's what Get Out represents in one perfect nutshell. And And Barry Jenkins represents that prestigious thing, you know, because, you know, it's still tough to get folks to come out and see films like Moonlight just because the palettes aren't as sophisticated as they could be. But what has happened is that somebody can duplicate Empire. That's no shade to Empire. I'm just saying, it's, you can take that and go, black folks dancing, singing, drugs, drama. You can duplicate, you know, something like Power, or you can say, okay, drug kingpin, cheats on his wife, got the da-da-da-da-da-da-da. You can't duplicate Atlanta. You can't duplicate Random Acts of Blindness. You really can't duplicate Get Out, because you don't have Get Out without Jordan Peele. You don't have Atlanta without the vision of Donald Glover. You don't have Master of None without Aziz and Allen deciding to do something that hasn't been done before. So now what the industry realizes is, oh, so we gotta go to the artist. We gotta go find a Jordan Peele. We gotta go find a Ryan Coogler. We gotta go find a Lena Waithe. And that now has put the power in our hands, because they finally understand that no one can do what I can do. This can't be duplicated. You can't fake what we do. You can't try to take it and sell it, you know, the generic version. They gotta come to the source. And my goal is, because as I'm in the forefront or people see me on TV or whatever, or because I have an Emmy or whatever that means, it's like my mission is to take the spotlight and to shed it on those artists who people don't know yet, who are just as talented, just as gifted, and just as amazing. You just have yet to find out their name because they haven't had an opportunity to put their work on TV or in movies. And I think my biggest mission is to expand the club, because right now it is a small, you can fit us all into one apartment, obviously. So my mission is that you get a mansion and we still need more room, because that's how many of us out here is brilliant and talented. This is the opportunity. That's my long-winded answer to that question.
No, it's a good answer. It's a good answer, and it kind of puts a fine point on the challenge, I think, for me anyway, it kind of puts a fine point on the challenge of getting studios to hear and see and validate people like you, because part of the underpinning of the business of movies, of television, of media, is being mass producible. You have to be able to create something and then put it out in as many different forms as possible without having to go start the hunt all over again.
Right, and look, they also want to make money and they want to be cool.
Right.
We make things cool and we make people money.
Today is National Coming Out Day.
Yeah, and I haven't tweeted or posted anything yet, but I will.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you.
I really want to say, like, I know I'm going to always be associated with coming out. Always.
Well, that's kind of what I wanted to ask you about, because there's an aspect of storytelling to one's own coming out. Mm-hmm. You know, you're telling your own story. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I feel like LGBT people like you and I kind of experience coming out like being at a pride parade. It's one thing to show up, but then you have to decide what float that you're going to walk with, mm-hmm. right? Like, it's one thing to say, you know, I'm a lesbian. It's another thing to say, I want to ride with the Dykes on bikes. Like, that's a whole other decision-making process. Because it reveals, it's like another chapter to your coming out story. What do you think it takes to work through those chapters? How have you worked through those for yourself?
I mean, well, a couple of things. As I ponder it, just the whole idea of National Coming Out Day, it's interesting because I saw someone's post is that, you know, you shouldn't necessarily push people to come out because everyone has a different experience. And obviously, some people are just very, you know, really want to wear like a badge of honor. Like, yeah, I came out 8 years ago, or I came out today, or whatever it may be. My thought, as I was thinking this morning, as I was like realizing there was National Coming Out Day, and I thought, oh, okay, I'm going to just, you know, post something or say something. But I remember I thought, oh, okay, that's where I've come to. I want us to live in a world where no one has to necessarily come out. Because they were raised in a home where they determined, not determined, but they told their parents what their gender was, and not a gender reveal party can do that. They understood that what it means to be non-binary or genderqueer or asexual or gay, lesbian, trans, or whatever it may be, that they can say that at the age in which they discover it, which is usually, you know, very young. So it's not them even coming out, it's them clarifying who they are. And I believe children should be able to say who they are just as easily as they can tell you what their favorite color is or what they like to watch on TV or what their favorite, you know, song is right now. I think that to me is really the goal, because the fact that people, when you don't do something, it's because you're afraid of it. So if it takes someone a long time to come out, it's because they fear what could happen. And I think that we still have a few more generations until we get to this, you know, oasis. But I believe that that is really the mission, is to continue to educate people about what it means to be othered or queer. But that, a big thing, too, in terms of, like, chapters and floats and things like that. I said, when I was very blessed to win an award from GLAAD for my episode, Thanksgiving, I said to the room that I don't want us to divvy up, you know, I don't want us to sit at different lunch tables. At the end of the day, we're all queer, so we're all under one umbrella. And we may live differently or identify differently or walk in different worlds, but we all have something in common. We all identify as some form of queerness. And that, to me, is one big group and one big family. And I don't want to separate myself by saying, oh, I'm a masculine-presenting African-American lesbian. It's like, yeah, that's fine. But at the end of the day, I'm different. And you're different. Technically, we're all kind of queer, if you think about it. But but I just don't want to separate myself. And I'm proud of those things. I'm proud of who I am and how I present. But, you know, and those things just come. You know, you just kind of figure out your swag and what you want to do and how you want to walk. But so I don't know that's just sort of been my journey, just kind of being myself. And this is a representation of, like, myself.
You use that word queer. Mm-hmm. And since we're dealing with communications professionals, I wonder how you view the value of terminology. I mean, I know some black gay men who refuse to call themselves gay because they associate being gay with a kind of predominantly white subculture. It feels like terminology is kind of a frontier, particularly for the wider culture, learning how to deal with people who aren't of the mainstream.
I mean, I think the reason why I use the word queer is because it just encapsulates, like, everything that I think. Because here's the deal, I feel like when you get too bogged down in that, then it makes it difficult for others to want to approach or communicate or talk. Now, people can identify however they choose. I think my biggest thing is, again, we're all the same. So, like, let's just kind of create, like, a word where we all can kind of be under the umbrella rather than... Now, that's not to belittle people's experiences or how everyone has a very different one, because I have a very different experience, say, from Laverne Cox. But we still the same bitch at the end of the day. Like, we still go through a lot of the same shit. She told me, like, her mom was, like, a reaction was a lot like mine on Thanksgiving. So it's like we all have the same shit. Like, I don't want to, like, we're all the same, man. We're all the same.
You're listening to a recorded conversation with actress, producer, writer, and showrunner Lena Waithe. We'll get back to it in just a moment. Stay close.
The following message comes from our sponsor, Capital One. Would you know if someone applied for credit using your Social Security number? If not, listen to Joe Whitchurch, head of the CreditWise app, talk about the new SSN tracker his team recently released.
While identity fraud is something everyone needs to be worried about, we want to make it easy and seamless for them to become aware of anybody attempting to use their identity without their knowledge or permission.
CreditWise is free for everyone, whether you're a Capital One customer or not. You can find CreditWise in your app or Play Store now.
Hey, it's Guy Raz here, host of the TED Radio Hour. And this week, we're going to explore just what it takes to speak up. Because whether it's asking for a raise or asking for equality, it requires courage to take that crucial step to say something. You can find the TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's get back to our conversation with Lena Waithe, the creator of Showtime's The Chi and an Emmy Award-winning writer on the Netflix series Master of None. We were speaking as the keynote session at ComNet 18, a yearly conference held by a group called the Communications Network. Here's where we get in some questions from the audience.
Good to see you. My name is Sylvia Ewing. I'm from Chicago.
Dope.
So no surprise, I have the mic first.
Yeah.
I thank you for taking our mind off of crazy Kanye. I said it. But what I'd like to know is, where do you see you in 10 years? And thank you.
Thank you. You know, it's so interesting. I got to ask God that. Truly. Because I didn't see myself here 5 years ago. And there really are, I mean, you really do got to take things as they come. Because I definitely wouldn't have thought I'd be in a Steven Spielberg movie. I didn't write, Emmy wasn't necessarily on my vision board. And didn't think I'd be doing the Boomerang version of the TV show with Halle Berry, you know, producing alongside with me. So I the opportunities, you know, come, and I want to take advantage of as many of them as I possibly can. But truthfully, for my hope is I will have a production company that can rival Plan B. I hope to not be singing for my supper as much. And I hope to, you know, but I think, you know, I can't help but include my personal life in that. I hope to have a kid that knows who they are and knows from whence that where they come, and be living in the house that I'm renovating right now with my who will be my wife then and no longer my fiance, and I hope that we'll continue to grow together and stand next to each other and continue to recommit to each other every day, and I hope to be more in love with her than I am right now. So that's my ultimate.
And just to clarify, yeah. Plan B, that's Brad Pitt's production company. That's company that did World War Z. Who's got the mic?
Yeah, man. Let's do it. I'm going to be faster.
Go ahead. Introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Nicole Narulias Gupte from Seattle, so I have the microphone second.
Yeah.
I would really like to hear about your thoughts on when a community is fighting for representation and you have people who have been held up as representatives, like a Bill Cosby, like a Kanye West. What does it mean when they behave in a way that's not representative?
What happens when they do, when someone does something like this doesn't reflect us? I mean, look, what happens when Woody Allen or Roman Polanski does something? You know what I'm saying? Because there are more of them than us, that it makes it easier to forget. Look, the Bill Cosby thing, here's the deal. Here's what I'll say. Heathcliff Huxtable was the only father I've ever known. So, because my own father wasn't there or as present as he could have been. He died suddenly when I was 14. So, I think sometimes people forget how much an image can do for a group of people who don't see themselves. So it's almost like a death, or again, I lost another father again. But there's also this other thing too, that we create the heroes in which we desire. Bill Cosby is skin and bones. He's made up the same stuff as we are. And sometimes we can forget that. Because we're like, no, you're special. There's something about you. But there's a thing about wanting to worship other people. It's not natural. Whitney Houston, she would always be, whenever she had a free moment, every time she would sleep. And I thought about this morning as well. I said, I think the reason why she slept so much is because she was so exhausted from being worshiped. When I walk out into the world, I experience it differently than you. Because when I walk out into the world, I belong to you in a way. I don't get to live like everybody else. There's an exchange of energy that is unbalanced. We are getting the energy from all of you, right? But I have to pour out more energy so that way all of y'all can get a piece of me. So that's why before I come out here, I have to do this. And when I leave, I have to refill my cup because I'm giving out more of myself, more of my energy than most people should. Now imagine this times 10, this times millions. You're not like everybody else, but you are. So the shit about Kanye or Bill or whatever, I have an understanding of like how these motherfuckers can go like crazy. Now Bill is different. Like that is like a fucking criminal. That's criminality. Right. Kanye, the crazy shit that's going on. That's, I think, of him not knowing how to refill his cup. That's just a long-winded answer about that. But I just don't think people should worship people. But that's not happening anytime soon. But
yeah, and before we get to the next question, which is where?
And I am going to try to keep it short. I do want to get some more in here. I'm sorry.
That's okay. I'll try to be a little more judicious about interrupting. Yeah. But to the point that you made about Bill Cosby versus Cliff Huxtable, it reminded me of an article that Wesley Morris wrote in the New York Times. The first sentence from the column is, if a sexual predator wanted to come up with a smokescreen for his ghastly conquests, he couldn't do better than Cliff Huxtable.
That's real.
Yeah. Let's get to the next question. Hi, introduce yourself and what's on your mind?
Hi, my name is Lauren Applebaum and I'm the communications director at Respectability. We're based outside of Washington, D.C. and our focus is on advancing opportunities for people with disabilities.
Got it.
So what I'd love to learn from you is how can those of us with disabilities who are trying to advocate for more accurate, positive portrayals of people with disabilities in TV and film learn from how much you've been able to advance for people of color? And I'd also like to point out that the disability market, according to Nielsen, is worth $1 trillion. So there is a money angle, which I know is important for the industry. So, but how do we just go about learning from you and advancing those opportunities?
Thank you for the question. I mean, the first thing I would do is say to take positive out of it. There's nothing I hate more than someone saying positive black images. If you only look at the good parts of a group of people, you are doing them a disservice. Equality is not just my black ass being the hero, but my black ass having the ability to play the villain as well. That's when the playing field is leveled. Michael B. Jordan's character is just as significant as Chadwick Boseman, as being Black Panther. Both are important. So, to me, to show people who live with disabilities is to not show them always being nice, good, and earnest, pleasant. That belittles that group of people. And I believe that, and I know the WGA, our Writers Guild, has, we all have different, you know, meetings, like women, black writers, Latino writers, but there's also a group for writers who live with disabilities. And sometimes they come to the black writers meetings, sometimes we go to there, sometimes we try to intermingle, because we all are othered in the world and in the business. And to me, it's about that group of people writing about their experiences, writing about their narrative. And also too, or a person who does not live with a disability can write about it, but then they better have someone who does sitting right next to them as they work on the script. And I think that is when true change happens, is when someone is empowered to tell their own narrative. And that will happen because somebody's going to tell the story and then other people will feel empowered to tell their story and so on and so on and so on and so on. And there's actually something, speaking of which is very interesting, we haven't done it yet, but I saw an ad, this young African-American guy wrote this sort of comic book about superheroes who have disabilities and how their disabilities help them save the world. And so I hit my exec and I was like, let's try to meet this guy and talk to him, because that was something that, even though obviously I'm an able-bodied person, but I was like, that's phenomenal. That's how I think, that the things that make us othered make us dope. Yeah. So, yeah. I'm gonna keep them shorter. Give me like three more questions. Can we got time? Can we get like a couple more?
We'll make them happen.
Come on,
we'll
see if we get
the mic now?
Let's do it. Because I do have to go. I gotta get on a f-ing plane.
The mic. We will not let you be late to SFO. Let's get to another question. Where
three or four, like just throw them the mic.
Can you ask a question super fast and we'll get you some more?
Quick, Alina, I'm a May from the African American Museum.
Boom, got it.
And I just wanted to know, how do you take up space as you walk into all of these different rooms, access to show up as yourself every day?
How?
Yes.
I don't know any other way to be, my love. I'll just do it. But also, too, I think it's like, that's like, how do you fall in love? You know what I'm saying? Like, you become the person you become. And I'm from Chicago. You know, I got a single parent, so you resourceful. I had a grandmother from the South, you know what I'm saying? Like, who like, got out of the South when she was 14. I come from a long line of people who don't give a shit. And I'm just like, let's go. I don't know. I believe that the space I take up is cool and interesting, and someone should be, you know, honored to be in the presence. So that's what you want to do.
Yes, ma'am.
Quick. Let's get it. Spit your question out.
Hi, my name's Ashlyn. I work with All for Animals in Santa Barbara. We use therapy dogs with kids and other demographics.
I have a dog as well. Great.
For those of us who are working with maybe very small or specific populations and we're trying to tell our stories, you're talking about common narratives. Is there something you look for in a character that you're writing or in a story that you're telling that differentiates them from everyone else who has that common narrative?
No, I mean, the truth is like my experience is mine. So however I look at characters or stories is going to be from my perspective. I'm going to look at the mic in somebody else's hand before we lose it. Do we have it? Can we do one more?
Let's see if we can squeeze one more, and then I'm going to get the last question. I'm going to take moderator's privilege for the last question. Yes.
Okay, fair enough.
One last question, right quick.
All right,
hi.
Sorry, guys.
I'm from Chicago, Jackie Davidoff. My question is, there is clearly a lot of pain in Chicago. Where do you see that people have not shifted to new paradigms? And what do you think that foundation philanthropic communicators can do to be part of that?
I'm going to disagree with you. I think there's a lot of joy in Chicago. I think that, you know, look, man, I think we are all a product of a country that was built on the backs of others. And that hasn't been, there's been no real appropriate apology for that. Hello. So whatever pain that exists in folks that look like us, is because we're waiting for an apology. And until that comes, we're gonna continue to live in a space in which we act as everything is okay, and it's not.
One last question before we let you go.
See, I could have got this young lady right here. She was like saying, come on, let's give it to her. Who cares, man? It's like we got time, man. Give her the mic. My bad.
Now
it's pressure. Now you gotta make it great.
What is the best story that you've never told?
That's a good one.
That's better than
one.
That's
good. Good.
Don't come on my job and show me up. Last question.
Best story I've never told. I haven't told my love story. Yet. Oh. yet, because it ain't done. It ain't done yet. So I hope to, you know, get to a place like, you know, further down the line where I can, like, step back and tell the story of us, she and I. And I hope that people can see themselves in us, you know, two girls from Chicago, her from the suburbs, me on the south side. I went to Columbia College, she went to Columbia University. It's all right. Always date someone smarter than you, who you can learn from. And we're at the very beginning, you know. We're engaged, and we have a dog, and we have a place, and we're just looking forward to building a life. But like I try to tell people, it's like I can make a bunch of movies and TV shows and act in a bunch of things, but the truth is, at the end of the day, she is my legacy. She's the legacy. Because when I go, they're gonna do that thing in memoriam where I'm gonna get maybe 4.5 seconds real shit. You know what I mean? And that's gonna be that. And people are like, okay. But if she can remember me fondly, if I can live up to the person which she thinks that I am, then it will all have been worth it.
Ladies and gentlemen, Lena Waithe.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, brother.
Let's get you on a plane.
I know, man.
You'll find video of our full conversation with actress, producer, writer, and showrunner Lena Waithe online at the1a.org. That's the word the, the number one, the letter a.org. This conversation was produced by Paige Osborne, with thanks to the Communications Network for inviting us to take part. You can learn more about her and the rest of our staff online at the1a.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Have a safe and fun Thanksgiving weekend, and we'll see you Monday. This is 1A.